From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. This show is heard weekly on radio stations around the world and relies on the financial support from listeners and sponsors. I'm John Steinman, and I'll be your host for the next hour. While our weekly broadcasts can often deliver shocking revelations of what's happening behind the scenes of our national and global food systems, we have in the past few weeks explored some of the positive steps communities are taking to respond to the many destructive, unethical, and exploitive practices being undertaken for the sake of convenient food. And today's show will continue on that stream and take off where our previous two broadcasts from the Future of Food in the Kootenai's Conference left off back in December. The two-day conference was hosted here in Nelson and accommodated 250 people on the first evening of keynote speakers and 170 during the following day of speakers and workshops. And as we've now heard from the keynote speakers today, and taking up the first 45 minutes of the show, we will listen in on two of the four workshops that were hosted at the conference, and in doing so get a better idea of the kind of dialogue that such a conference can help inspire in North American communities wishing to assume greater control over their food. Some of the voices we will hear on today's broadcast will be of Jeremy Lack of Mad Dog Farm, located just outside of Nelson and Terry's, Wayne Harris, a dairy farmer in Creston, B.C., Merv Schloss of Local Flavors Products and Services Cooperative, also located in Creston, Herb Barbalit of Simon Fraser University's Center for Sustainable Community Development, and the many voices of conference delegates. And rounding off today's broadcast, we will feature the fifth installment of our ongoing Conscientious Cooks series, with this episode featuring Saskatoon's Daniel Walker of Vacheria.
Deconstructing Dinner is made possible by the generous support from the G. Raymond Chang School of Continuing Education Certificate in Food Security at Ryerson University. The Chang School offers you food for thought in your exploration of food issues and impacts, including urban agriculture. For more information about this unique distance education program, visit ryerson.ca/CE/food security.
Back in November 2007, the community of Nelson, located in the Kootenai region of British Columbia, hosted a regional conference to address the future of food in the Kootenais. The conference was sparked by elevated concerns over the rising price of oil, climate change, corporate control of the food system, declining nutrient values in our food, environmental impacts of the dominant food system serving Canadians, and the increasing difficulties facing small-scale farming and food production. As such an event can act as inspiration for other communities to organize a similar conference, Deconstructing Dinner compiled a team of volunteers to capture as much as we could of the dialogue taking place there. And located on our website is a page that has been devoted exclusively to featuring all of the unedited recordings along with PowerPoint presentations of the keynote speakers. Now, back in December, we did feature two broadcasts that shared a number of the conference's keynote speakers. We heard from Richard Balfour on the diminishing of all resources that our way of life is dependent upon. We heard from Justin Roller on the current and precarious state of the global supply of oil. And we heard from MLA Corky Evans, who suggested that politicians should instead be looked to ensure government simply stays out of the way of those looking out for community interests. With the conference's keynote speakers looking to inspire the 170 in attendance during the final day of workshops, delegates were then able to attend two of four themes, which included the technical aspects of farming, community development, economics, and regulations. Now, regrettably, our recording of the economics workshop was lost due to what amounts to unexplainable technological errors, but the wonders of technology did preserve three of the four. And I will remind you that the unedited versions of these workshops are archived on our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner. The first workshop we'll listen in on was the technical aspects of farming. A panel of farmers was set up to help set the stage for the dialogue that took place. But what stood out first and foremost was the wealth of experience among conference delegates, and it became quite clear early on during the workshop introductions that hiding in the recesses of our communities throughout North America exists a wealth of skills and knowledge that a conference such as the one taking place in Nelson can help unearth. And here's a brief clip, an example of those attending this workshop.
My wife and I have a farm in Beasley.
In the Slocan Valley, and I used to raise beef cattle for 40 years.
And I live in Nelson, and I run the local farmers market for the West Kootenai Eco Society.
And my partner and I are starting a small subsistence farm in Glade. It's our first year, but I farmed for 8 years in Oregon, on the coast of New Zealand.
And I also work for the Land Conservancy of British Columbia, and I also assisted one of the local organic farms in Fruitvale start a community-supported agriculture program.
From Grand Forks, I'm a certified organic farmer. I'm a member of Boundary Organic Producers Association, and I also work with the Grand Forks Fall Fair.
I'm Nelson. I'm also an eater. I found out last night that should maybe be my primary label right now, but I've been gardening in this area for many years, and I'm interested in all sorts of things about how to make that better and how to have us all have a little backyard.
I work in the School of Renewable Resources, Selkirk College, and I'm a Soil Matters CSA member.
I've been gardening organically since I was 17 and raised most of the food for my 5 children.
I'm a backyard gardener and just moved from Victoria. I grew up in Rosslyn just trying to get the local seed.
I grew enough potatoes this year in my backyard to last me till spring.
All right. I live in the Slocan Valley, and I'm a gardener.
Recently moved here from Nova Scotia, where I've been farming all my life.
According to my husband, I'm a muffin maker.
I'm also a beekeeper, but not a beekeeper.
Helping to set the stage for the workshop was a panel of local farmers, with the first being Jeremy Lack of Mad Dog Farm, located in the community of Terry's.
We are currently a market garden in that we grow vegetables basically from A to Z, except we plowed in the asparagus because it didn't pay. We used to do sheep, we used to do meat birds, we used to do poultry and turkeys and stuff. We had to stop that when the government screwed us. And I'm still very pissed off about that. We're trying to fix things by building a local abattoir in conjunction with a load of other people. One of the problems with not having livestock on a farm is that your fertility goes down. You can cover crop all you like. Unless you are doing very slow agriculture, you cannot build fertility in the soil without some sort of livestock input. This is what we found in this region. I think it may be a symptom of the fact that our climate is, our growing season, our warm season is so small. We grow in greenhouses for season extension. We grow in the fields. We use a lot of covers to keep the sun off the potatoes so they don't cook in the soil in the summer, to stop the frost in the spring and stop the frost in the fall. It is a very challenging environment to grow in. The only thing that makes it worthwhile is that it's relatively easy to sell the produce here. There's quite a high demand, and for that we are always grateful. So thank you.
Also on the panel was Wayne Harris, a dairy farmer from Creston.
So we have a dairy operation in Creston. We milk about 80 cows, my wife, and we have 3 kids. Our farm, when we purchased it, would have been considered a conventional farm. The cows were strictly in confinement. Shortly after we purchased it, we moved to rotational grazing, which grazing dairy cattle in Canada is very uncommon now. And that is just more or less led us down the road to organics. In fact, next year we'll be certified organic. That's led another challenge to us in that in this area, there's no processing of dairy products, conventional or organic. But certainly if we want to put them into an organic stream, we have to process those ourselves. So we're currently building a fromagerie on the farm, where we'll take at least a portion of our production initially and start to produce some cheese. Certainly as we've gone down the road towards organics, it's been more and more interesting. It really wakens you up as to the potential of the land to go organically, and certainly awakens you to that agriculture isn't headed down necessarily the right road, strictly staying to conventional.
The third of the 4 panelists was Merv Schloss, also a farmer from Creston, and one of the creators of a new cooperative that is being formed that we will learn more about later on the show.
I started off in 1991 buying a farm, converted to certified organic, and proceeded to do all the things and make all the mistakes that a lot of other farmers have done. I farmed, I then distributed it, I found my own market, I spent a lot of time in all of the steps right through to the retail end of it. And I found that I did none of them well because I was too scattered. I needed to go back and either be a farmer or be a processor or be a distributor. And playing all of those parts, I learned a lot of hard lessons and found that there had to be a better solution. So about 6 years ago, Creston started having sustainable agriculture conferences. I became quite involved in those, and about 3 years ago, I met people from small-scale food processors and became a director of that about 3 years ago. And from that, in 2005, they had done a lot of research funded by the federal government, and they had just embarked on Local Flavors Products and Services Cooperative, which has been 3 years in the growing. I became a director of that as well, and from that, discovered that if through an appropriate cooperative, we could have each of the players doing their respective parts and coming together for the common things that we needed, that it could work.
And the final panelist at the Technical Aspects of Farming workshop was Netta Zeberoff, a master herbalist and experienced gardener from Castlegar.
I'm third generation de Kubor, and I was raised very close to nature. I followed my grandmothers and my grandfathers around foraging for food and medicine. We never got vaccinated and never went to doctors, so it was all home remedies and home canning and nothing, very little was from the store, salt, but everything was homegrown. You know, you trade with your neighbors, and you've got your cabbage, your potatoes, your beets, your carrots, your root cellar is full. You buy your salt and your sugar, and you're set for the winter. I used to grow enough food and canned enough for 3 years every year. And it's such a, I'm so blessed to have been given these gifts, and I enjoy sharing my knowledge.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, where we are embarking on a journey through some of the workshops comprising the November 2007 Future of Food in the Kootenays Conference held in Nelson, BC. In this next segment, we listen in on conference delegates sharing their thoughts on how the Kootenay region can become the home to a more sustainable local food system that is more socially and environmentally responsible. We will hear comments on food storage, linking willing farmers up with available land, agricultural education, the sharing of equipment, seed sourcing, sustainable water use, farmers markets, and wild foods.
Yeah, if you're really going to eat local and all during the winter, I think food storage, either at a centralized or individual households. Okay. And how do you do that? Because we don't all dig a root cellar. So how do you store all your cabbages and carrots and parsnips?
Cool. Thank you.
How to get want-to-be farmers onto land that they can farm when farmland is sitting mostly underutilized.
As a farmer, we have the land and we have the demand, but we don't have the infrastructure, the fencing, and the equipment. I know on the coast that there's different restaurants sponsoring young farmers to help them grow their farms and acquire land. Maybe that's something that we need to do in this area as well.
Effective use of water, getting the most most out of your soil for the minimum use of water.
Yeah. One of the problems in starting out small farming in this area is if you want to get into large-scale cropping of anything, you need the equipment to do it. There is no real agricultural base of equipment in this area, and one of the ideas we've been toying with is whether to set up a tool lending library for farmers, for potato diggers, for root diggers, for whatever equipment is required that you don't use all the year, that can be shared adequately between farmers in an area. I don't know whether that would spark any interest in people.
Can we talk about seed sources also?
Sure.
So specifically adapted for this area?
So our own sort of, developing our own sort of seed bank?
We get our water from the creek, and I'd like to know more about really the more sustainable ways to get that water onto the crops, and also possibly a hydroelectric
micro-hydro. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I run the farmer's market in town, and I could see we could use more people to come and buy products sometimes. Sometimes farmers actually take produce home with them.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sit very well. And if we had more people come and buy produce at our local market here, that would attract more farmers and encourage more farmers.
We need to be planning for a no-oil farming system. So animals go back to hand plows or something. I don't know. We have to rethink this whole thing and gather the resources, both the equipment and the people who are still knowledgeable in those techniques, and retrain ourselves so that we can adapt if we need to.
Right. So non-fossil fuel
alternatives.
Yeah.
Along the same vein as seed saving, we need kind of like a resource for livestock sourcing, because we are using sometimes breeds of animals on subsistence farming that are rare here, but well suited for the climate. Some of the longer haired breeds of cattle, some of the lighter draft horses that can, such as the Fjords, those things, you know, the horses that we had in the past were $5,000 an animal, which is prohibitive really for most people. And then if you've got a team that is related to each other, where do you breed that out? I know that as I'm networking, I'm finding a lot more small farmers in the area that sometimes have a similar breed of an unusual animal. So it's almost like we need a networking or a catalog of who has which animals for breeding purposes, just to keep that sustainable part of that farming going.
Well, I think we need land. We need farmland. And I could see it being like a land trust similar to, land trusts are set aside for conservation. But I think we need land trusts that set aside farmland.
I like the idea that we heard of last night, where anyone who's going to own land that's part of the agricultural land reserve has to be farming it and not just sitting on it with a trophy house, because it's going to be pretty hard to turn that into a farm if someone's allowed to build a trophy house there.
I think a really important point is starting to become really familiar with the indigenous plants of this area, and that they're getting moved over by some of these super weeds, like these weeds that are just taking over our landscape, and that these indigenous plants were what fed the people here before we even thought of farming. And so at least starting to have a portion of our attention on that and how to reclaim our lost wild places back and actually help those indigenous plants, like the Saskatoon berry, like the huckleberry, like the camas root, and all those plants come back to their natural landscape.
Sure.
So maybe, I don't know what you call that, wild farming or just...
I wanted to ask if anyone has already created a questionnaire. I thought, because Burton is only maybe a little over 200 people, and I'd hope to create a questionnaire, get it out to everyone. What fruit trees do you have on your land? How many of them, what are the varieties? What are in good shape? What are old? How many acres of tillable land do you have? Just to get a feel for our community. And I just wondered if anyone knows of anyone who's already created that questionnaire, so I wouldn't have to create it. But I will if no one else has.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, and we're listening in on a collection of clips recorded at the November 2007 Future of Food in the Kootenays Conference. In this next segment from the brainstorming taking place during the Technical Aspects of Farming workshop, we hear more from conference delegates and also from panelist and farmer Jeremy Lack, who speaks of the untapped potential within communities to support local farming and food production. And the untapped potential he's referring to are the many chain grocery stores who refuse to create the space for locally grown and processed foods. We will hear one idea of how the public can begin putting pressure on their local chain grocers.
I think one of the keys to increasing agriculture in this area is to increase the market. I mean, if we could persuade the overweighties, the extra foods and all that lot to at least put a portion of their stuff into what's produced locally, would be a huge step up. When you go and talk to them as a farmer, try and get your stuff onto their shelves, they're not interested. Well, they're interested, but you'd have to ship it to Calgary or to Edmonton or Toronto, and then they'll ship it back. Well, yeah, there's not much point in that. And even with the eggs, for example, there's small egg producers around here. You can't sell your eggs legally. So maybe one of the things that we need to look at is to produce a provincially approved egg packing plant. $20,000, $15,000, and you just bring your eggs in, get them packed, get them candled. How many more small farmers would that help? Local producers, quite a lot, I think.
One thing that I've started doing, and I really encourage everybody, and we can even put it to the place where we have a card that we actually hand in, where it will say, I today did not buy, and then we can fill it in because it wasn't local. And then every time we shop as our support for the farmers, we can let all these stores know, today I didn't buy my milk and my eggs from you because they're from California. Today I didn't buy my apples. And so every single day, these stores are going to hear from this community why we are not buying their products. And eventually, it's going to have to change, because as long as we keep buying it and saying, well, that's too bad, it's never going to change, and our farmers will not be a part of this local market. So.
Troublemaker, you.
Good idea.
Good one, huh? Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Jeremy? I mean, Endless Harvest is great. They are very, very responsive. Kootenai Co-op is very, very responsive. But the problem is that there is only two outlets in this area that take a lot of produce. Ferrero Foods in Roslyn takes local produce. There's nobody in Castlegar. They're not interested because there's no demand, they say. If you're going to expand the number of farmers in this area, then you have to create more outlets. The current outlets are pretty maxed out with what local production there is. And local production here for the majority of farmers is that 6-week period, July and August, and then they're fried, and there's nothing before that. Unless you can sort of get farms to schedule early in the season and late in the season, you have to create more of a market for new farmers in the summer. There are very few of us who do winter extension, spring extension, very few of us who do winter extension, and there are very few of us who do root crops for storage. I mean, we're lucky we built, not lucky, maybe stupid, but we built a cold store. It was one of the first things we did when we started the farm, so we can store our produce.
Now, this will be an upcoming topic on Deconstructing Dinner, that is, the unwillingness of chain grocers to provide the space for locally grown and produced foods. Back in March of 2006, we aired a show titled Local Producer Spotlight, during which four Nelson area farmers and producers shared their experience of how positive of an impact it can be when a large chain retailer accommodates their product. And the misguided approach by Canada's major retailers was made most apparent during the recent advertising campaign for Loblaw Companies Limited private label brand President's Choice and their line of organic baby food. It was during that television campaign when Loblaw CEO Galen Weston Jr. announced that their organic baby food was produced using sustainable methods of farming. Now, this statement will provide the groundwork for our upcoming broadcast on the role of national retailers in supporting local producers. Because if local food production is agreed to be the most sustainable form of producing food, then selling pureed carrots or pureed strawberries from product shipped in from California is far from being sustainable. I would even go so far as to suggest that the statement is bordering on false advertising, given its products like President's Choice organic baby food, that because of this long-distance sourcing of ingredients, is contributing heavily to the financial instability and demise of Canadian farmers, unable to compete with such cheap imports. Another interesting comment made during the workshop was one that will yet again set the stage for a future broadcast, and that is the role of post-secondary education, and in particular community colleges, in providing agricultural programs for area residents.
The value of community colleges, besides just training technicians and people in liberal arts and so on, as we do very well, is actually the old idea of the community college, which is to serve the needs of the community, the educational needs of the community, not just for higher education, but mm-hmm. for skills and training. We, of course, have that with a trade school to some extent, but I'm talking about more, what I'm thinking about more is basically a kind of center of learning to bring together people like mentors from the community that already are the experts on many of these local skills, to provide kind of a central data bank, but also a place to coordinate that educational opportunity. I mean, it's just a harebrained idea at this point, but some of you have read The Long Emergency, it was referred to last night by that book by Kunstler, who talks about that in the near future, all of us higher educators, as occurred in Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union, have no more employment anyway, because it's not a really valued skill. What is going to be valued are all these local subsistence type skills, not just in agriculture, but in all kinds of realms. And I'm a firm believer that is the future we'll be looking at. And many of you are convinced, at least after last night, I'm sure, that is the future we're looking at. So why not the community colleges and high schools and other public institutions of education start to right now look at mm-hmm. providing some of those and give ourselves some future employment as well.
The Future of Food in the Kootenays Conference was also an event that Creston's Merv Schloss chose to use as a place to officially announce the creation of Local Flavors Products and Services Cooperative in Creston. Merv sat on the panel of the workshop we've been listening in on, and this newly formed cooperative will also make its way into an upcoming broadcast of our ongoing series titled Cooperatives, Alternatives to Industrial Food. And here's Merv Schloss introducing this exciting and innovative idea to foster more food secure and environmentally responsible communities, where instead of competing with one another, farmers instead cooperate, so that both they and the public benefit.
What we're talking about here is a lot of different aspects of farming, but where I have seen the problem in the past is that farmers have competed with each other. Jeremy addressed that. When we're fresh in the summer, we all have carrots, we all have onions, we all have potatoes. So we sell them at the same market that John runs, and we compete with each other, and that keeps the price fair. But everybody in this room eats 12 months of the year. So what we envision is that after you've finished supplying the fresh market, you should also grow enough produce so that 12 months of the year, the food that you eat in the Kootenays is grown in the Kootenays. So what we have done in Creston is we've secured a depot, and we are now starting in January on our first processing plant. We also came to Nelson, and I've talked to people in Nelson about also securing a depot so that there can be a van running from the depot in Nelson to pick up the product from the farmers instead of each one of the farmers driving that into Nelson or driving it to the various customers. That van picks it up and also delivers to various places on a small van. Then we do the same thing in Creston with a small van. So we have a depot in Creston that picks up from the farmers, brings it to the depot, and then we have a route now established from Vancouver to Calgary once a week and stopping in the southern route at each of the communities to participate in this. What that allows the farmer in Creston to do is have a market for his product that he can process or in some way store or whatever, and then each week the people in Nelson that want certain product, and we're talking large volumes, we're talking what the grocery store is supplying you with now, replacing that with local products. We have a large number of farmers in Creston who are sitting idle because they have no way of getting their product to the market. They can't do all the steps. So what we're suggesting in Creston especially is that we produce as much food as you need here, but the farmer has made a lot of false starts over the years because he couldn't find the market. It's here, but the connect between Creston and Nelson has not been made. So what we're trying to do is make that connection. So the farmer now knows in March or April when he plants his product that you're going to eat it in the fall or during the next year. So we need some assurance from this group that you want large-scale production from Creston, which is capable of doing it. And right now we're looking at trucks, but there's another option that was discussed. There's a large barge that exists in Creston right now. The food could be delivered a few kilometers down the road to Kuskanuk Harbor, put on the barge and floated along at very little diesel fuel and stop at Balfour and stop at Nelson and feed Caslow from the where the ferry boat landing is. So that can only be done with a central depot where the farmer says, yes, not only can I grow it, but you'll process, you'll make the soups, you'll make the juices, you'll do all of the production in Creston for the Kootenay market. If the Kootenay absorbs all of the produce that's produced by Creston, wonderful. If you don't and the farmer has more produce, we move it further along the supply chain to Kelowna or to the coast. We have players on the coast in Vancouver and Vancouver Island that are doing exactly the same thing as we're doing here. They're producing for their market. If there's excess, the farmers are making money. They move it further down the supply chain in other parts of the province. There needs to be a connect with those players so that each one of them does their job the best that they can. The farmer can stay home and farm. He doesn't have to compete with his neighbor. It's a cooperate with your neighbor, get a fair price for your product, because you're all selling to the same customers with the same local branding, the same name, and that relationship works for everybody because the farmer now can stay at home. He doesn't have to beat the pavement. He doesn't have to come up with his own market, or 20 farmers don't have to call somebody at the co-op and say, do you want my tomatoes or my carrots? One dispatch person from Creston calls and says, what do you need on your order sheet? That goes back to the farmer. This is what we want. And the people in Nelson say, these are the products we want. In the spring, we go back to the farmer and say, this is what you need to grow for that market. So there's no wasting of product. And all of the culls that exist in our market, right now I think we compost as much as 500,000 pounds of cherries because they're seconds. Their 11s are smaller, they're left on the tree. If the stems are off, they're composted. We think those should be processed and used in the market. So that requires the consumer to say, yes, we'll buy your product. And yes, we want you to grow for us. So right now the farmers don't have a way of moving past their market because we don't know where it is. So each one of them goes on the road with their little truck and uses a lot of fuel. But they don't end up with enough to make a living because they're doing all the jobs. And while they're out marketing on the road, their crop is drying up because nobody's home to water it. So you have to give the farmer support in their area to grow what you want them to grow. So that's kind of the basis of it. So we do have a depot in Creston, and we do have one. We're talking to Aria right now about being a depot for Nelson. Because she has a freezer, a cooler. She said, yes, that she would go with that.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, and that was Merv Schloss of Creston, British Columbia's Local Flavors, Products, and Services Cooperative. And we'll learn more about this unique model on an upcoming broadcast. But in the meantime, you can learn more by visiting their website at localflavors.coop. And this is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. And a reminder that you can learn more about this program and listen to archived broadcasts or subscribe to our free podcast by visiting our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner. And we also encourage your financial support of this not-for-profit project of Kootenai Co-op Radio. In the final 15 minutes of today's broadcast, we'll listen in on part 5 of our ongoing series, Conscientious Cooks, when we will meet with Saskatoon's Dan Walker, the owner and chef of Vacheria, a small restaurant whose support for farmers acts as a model for other restaurants looking to take on similar and more responsible roles within the food system. But first, we come back to the last segment of the farming workshop at the Future of Food in the Kootenays Conference, and it's on the topic of civil disobedience, an idea introduced during part 1 of this Future of Food series. There has been, for quite some time, an increasing number of barriers faced by farmers and food producers when choosing to operate on a small scale and provide for their communities. With food being as integral as it is to health, well-being, vibrant local economies, and environmental sustainability, civil disobedience becomes an increasingly attractive option when such barriers seem to be increasing in number. And here presents the word of the day, fruitleggers.
There is a place for civil disobedience, too. Years ago, you know, the BC Fruit Marketing Board controlled all the fruit going out of the Okanagan. You were allowed to take out, as a civilian, 2 bushels of fruit was it. And that was at a time when fruit growers were getting paid very poorly. And there was a network of us, we were actually called fruitleggers, who took that system down by hauling fruit up in large quantities. And I can remember in 1976, if you were growing Golden Delicious apples, through the marketing board, you would get 7 cents for those apples in March. We could pay 30 cents a pound in July, cash. So, the system came down pretty quick. But, it meant taking that sort of civil disobedience step to bring it down. Like, this meat thing is like, it kind of drives you crazy. It's like, who are these people who think they can do this? Yeah. It's maybe we just carry on. And then when the feds come to shut it down, maybe there's 200 of us there. I mean, there is a place for that.
Just as another option for civil disobedience, I'm wondering about how many people could just start keeping chickens in their backyards within city limits. Because that would be a pretty hard bylaw to enforce if a lot of people were doing it. And I don't know what the regulations are, if there's progress being made there in terms of changing those, but it's an idea that piqued my interest.
And you can stay tuned for an upcoming broadcast of our ongoing series, Farming in the City, when we will explore in depth the role of and politics behind backyard chickens. A quick reminder that located on the Deconstructing Dinner website is a page devoted to all of the audio recordings we compiled back in November at the Future of Food in the Kootenays Conference, and those include the unedited versions of the workshops that we're listening to today. And again, that website, cjly.net/deconstructingdinner. Yet another workshop topic was community development, And that was facilitated by Colleen Matt of Nelson-based Earth Matters, a youth-driven environmental organization and a partner of Deconstructing Dinner. Among the panelists at the workshop was Herb Barbalit of Simon Fraser University's Center for Sustainable Community Development in Burnaby, British Columbia. Herb has a long history with food security in Canada, and among his many roles helped launch Vancouver's Farm Folk City Folk, a nonprofit organization working with communities in BC to develop local and sustainable food systems. In this next clip, we hear Herb's definition of community development and its contrasting ethic to that of mainstream economics. We also hear from conference delegates on gardening clubs, the demographics separating healthy social interactions, and the creation of land trusts, among other topics.
But my background is in community development. I've been doing that for 100 and some odd years. And I realized a while back that community development wasn't community development unless it was community economic development, and the economics of it was essential. But the economics that we were taught in school, the economics that are the mainstream economics, is mythology, is ideology, and is nonsense. And the real economics is the community economics, and the mainstream economic system just ignores community and says it's all about corporations and trade and selfishness. So I want to bring back economics into community, and community and growing in food are basically the most important things. The essential thing here, too, is that the introductions that just occurred, linking and connecting, forming systems, not having all of these separate projects, but putting them together and building upon one another is absolutely essential. Local, yes, but as local as possible, because we need to support one another on the ground in our local communities, but in the larger and larger communities as well. That's my definition of community development.
Thank you very much. So now I'd like to open it up to anybody who has ideas or thoughts of what needs to happen on a community scale, what kind of projects you would like to see happen.
Creston has a very good active garden club. And for backyard gardens, gardeners, that's a really good way to go. I would say the average age of them, I look young there. And I'm not that young. The average age is probably 70 to 75. But the wealth of knowledge there is amazing. They have a seed exchange. They have potlucks. They have a monthly speaker on a timely topic. They have a plant exchange in the spring. They go on garden tours.
I wanted to address just one small point that you said about most of the people in the garden club are 70 and up. And what I find in our communities is our age groups are very isolated, and myself and my son's father are working like dogs basically to get ahead, and my son is isolated in care, and his grandparents are isolated in other areas, and if we start to join our elders again with our children and actually create these communities, the kids are going to get the knowledge that they used to get from the elders, the parents will have support. My child will have richer relationships, and maybe together in that kind of village structure, we can start to work together a little bit more.
Going back to what you were talking about, I had this beautiful fantasy not too long ago, how there's an age group that own a lot of land and have a lot of that land, and what's missing is that family connectedness. And, you know, being a young person and a farmer, it's hard to imagine having kids and raising kids and farming. Mm-hmm. And I had this beautiful fantasy of if these older people who own this land, if somehow there was some sort of evolution where we got back to more of a natural family structure where it's the older generation who raised the kids, and if that land was made available for people to farm and produce food, it would be a beautiful thing.
To make agricultural land productive land is what you're saying.
Yeah, and make it available, because a lot of the prime land is owned by baby boomers who either don't have the energy or intention to farm it. And that's been my problem, is I want to farm, but getting tenure on land, getting access to land is my main problem.
Well, I think a land trust is a really viable way to take land out of the market and put it into a trust, just like we do for environmental reasons. There's the Land Conservancy. That land is made available for farming, and people can live on it, farm it, And if you stop farming it, then you can't live there anymore. So that's, I think that's something we need to form in the Kootenays, is a Kootenay agricultural land trust, or at least a land trust.
I just wanted to add something to this, which is I keep coming back to thinking there has to be some way we can create incentives for people who hold ALR land to use it for agriculture. There has to be, somehow there has to be a paradigm shift where it's seen as being in the greater good for this land to be used, and there be incentives for people to use it, whether it's a greater tax break or not giving you the tax break unless you use the land agriculturally or something. You know, there has to be incentives for that agricultural land to be used so people just don't sit on huge tracts of beautiful arable land and not use it, which is what you're talking about, right?
Economic development is the key to community development. Without sustainable economic structures, communities are going to be dependent on the multinational corporations, and that's the way the whole international system is set up right now, so that our politicians are hamstrung to be able to do some of the things that they'd like to do, or some of them are. Some of them welcome the hamstringing, and the cult of impotence that Linda McKagan wrote about is there. It's real. And it feeds the vested interests of some portions of the community.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. In wrapping up segments from the community development workshop that we recorded at the November Future of Food in the Kootenays Conference, we hear one suggestion from a delegate on how to effectively share with others the innovative and important information that can arise out of a regional conference on food security.
And jumping off on the point of only talking to our friends and the whole, I think, on the original flip chart from this morning about, convincing people not to buy their groceries at Walmart, sometimes you just have to be provocative on the playground when you're dropping your kids off at school and start up conversations like, let's talk about food. Or, you know, you'd be surprised at how receptive people are to being challenged, and not being challenged, but, you know, yes, some people are going to be irritated and walk away, but I'm actually quite pleasantly surprised usually about how willing people are to sometimes engage. And even, you know, just talking amongst my own family, you know, they're pretty committed Walmart shoppers, pretty committed non-organic shoppers, but just in the last 2 months since being here, my mother was the one that dredged up the pamphlet for this conference for me. So once people know that you're interested, they do start changing the way they think.
It isn't just about being logical and getting the information out there. I mean, the information about climate change or whatever is totally out there. It's been available for a long time. Why do people turn the other way or not go with it? It's talking about all these things. It's so much having to also consider the emotional health of people and how much percentage of our decisions and our actions is based on information and logic, and how much is based on our emotional state. I don't know the exact detail. It's different for different people, but even different villages will have a different mentality. Like Burton, I know a lot what it is. I don't know exactly what it is here, but Burton, it's a lot of very independent, retired people, and they don't so much want to work together with other people very much. So I think to get things moving in any community, it also takes being aware of how to speak to people and how to present this information and how to acknowledge where people are at emotionally. It's a big job, but it truly seems to be a part of it.
And that wraps up part 3 of the Future of Food in the Kootenays Conference series here on Deconstructing Dinner. Again, a full page of audio recordings and broadcasts is available on our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner. And you can stay tuned for future episodes of the series when we will, perhaps most importantly, examine the outcomes of the conference in Nelson. And again, we hope that this series will act as a resource for other communities wishing to launch their own food security conferences, and the web-based resources provided on our site act as a foundation for such a community-driven response to the fragile state of our food systems. Taking us through till the end of today's broadcast will be part 5 of our ongoing series here on Deconstructing Dinner titled Conscientious Cooks, a series where we will explore chefs who are carrying out their work using more socially and environmentally responsible practices than is more commonly found in the food service sector. Back in September 2007, I visited Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, where Chef Daniel Walker calls home. Dan owns and operates Vacheria, a small restaurant in the central core of the city where he incorporates a set of unique values that are literally visible on the walls of the restaurant. Adorning the walls of Vecheria is a series of black and white photographs featuring some of the farmers and producers that Dan relies upon for his menu's ingredients. Of greatest interest to Dan Walker's efforts to support local farmers is how surprisingly unique his concept is in a province known as the breadbasket of the world. While such a designation would suggest that restaurants serving local food would be common, the breadbasket of the world designation is only in reference to industrial and global production of grains. With the exception of factory hog production and wild mushrooms, the presence of other food industries in Saskatchewan is rather minimal. Following a tasty dinner of freshly caught pike from the northern lakes of the province, I sat down with Daniel Walker to learn why he chose to open such a restaurant.
The idea of doing local food and the hospitality, of taking something from the farm and bringing it to the city, is kind of the basis of our philosophy. The training that I had in Vancouver with the chefs that I worked for, they're all French guys, and they were basically, their whole premise of what they learned was everything within 10 miles of their village is what they cooked with, type of thing, and it's everything was in season, so you had strawberries in June or July, and that was it, and then tomatoes for a short period of time. So that's always kind of resonated with me because, again, I'm from Saskatchewan, and I mean, theoretically, we're the breadbasket of the world for, you know, I guess early 20s, 30s, and 40s. We were one of the largest producers of grain, still are. And it's a part of the heritage of being from this province, I think. And just taking all that and kind of melding it together into what we do here is what has made our restaurant, I think, unique.
The highlight of my time spent with Chef Daniel Walker of Vecheria was the guided tour of the many local farmers and producers who supply the restaurant with its daily changing ingredients. Now, I traveled a very short distance to take this tour because Daniel proudly displays photographs of some of these producers on the wall of his restaurant. One of his suppliers happens to be a past guest of Deconstructing Dinner, Wally Satsowich, an urban farmer growing food in the city itself. But before we embark on this stationary tour, I asked Daniel to list some of the foods that are uniquely Saskatchewan.
Lentils, the wild mushrooms, our freshwater fish, beef. The beef that I deal with is a pure Black Angus. They can trace it all the way back to some of the first Black Angus brought into Canada. It's amazing. Bison, we have several really, really good bison producers here. Chickpeas, red fife wheat is another one of the bakery that I deal with. She bakes red fife loaves, and she does artisanal bread, so it's different every day for a week, and then it repeats itself every week, but you have to kind of get that when it's there, and it's exceptional bread. It's really, really good, really dense, like a rye, but with a really not so heavy kind of molasses-y flavor. It's actually quite nice.
We're standing right now beside a wall of your restaurant here with 8 framed photographs of your suppliers, of your farmers, and maybe we can go through each one here, and you can maybe give me a little story as to who they are, and this looks like your bakers right here. So this is, who's this right here?
This is Tracy and Blair Mazzolini. Their father's, well actually, Christie's Bakery has been open since 1932, and Tracy's dad bought the bakery in 64, I think. I could be wrong in the date. And now he's passed the bakery along to Tracy and Blair, and they do, and she learned her baking from a gentleman in Toronto, I think. She was actually one of the first employees Sister Lee ever had in Toronto, and he really instilled into her work ethic and that, and she makes amazing bread. It's phenomenal. She's also a member of Team Canada. It's unreal, the amount of talent this girl has. The bread's just unreal. We have Helga. You know what? Some of these people, I don't know their last names, but Helga does all my herbs. Basically, what I get from her is I get the cuttings. As the herbs grow too big, I get what she cuts off, and she sells them at the farmer's market here. The majority of the people that are on the wall here at the market, but the only two that aren't is the bread Christie's and then Paddock Brewery. She has a small, actually I shouldn't say small, but a couple of fair-sized greenhouses, and one of them is devoted completely to basil plants. And the other one's devoted to a number of other herbs and that. But she sells, I don't know, I'd say at least they're both 30 varieties of herbs at the market. And they're
relatively inexpensive. They're mainly for people that want to grow stuff in their houses and stuff like that, or the gardens. We have Wally and Gail, and Wally you've talked to once before. Wally is, to me, is the god of gardening in Saskatoon. This gentleman does such amazing product, and I get, we have carrots, about six different colors, a number of different kinds of tomatoes, different kinds of beets, different kinds of tomatoes and potatoes, all sorts of greens, Swiss chard, different kinds of spinach, arugula, mustard greens. See, now I got to think about what I get. Flowers, I get flowers from Gail, all sorts of really, really cool bouquets, and that's shallots, you name it, pickling onions, it's amazing.
Now, not everybody who listens to Deconstructing Dinner may remember this interview with Wally. They're growing their food in a far different way than any other farmer. What's the story behind where they're getting their food from?
He's utilizing, or recycling, I guess would be a good way of putting it, people's backyards and the gardens that these people have, and either that they don't want to garden anymore, or they want to have a garden in their backyard but don't want to go through the fuss and the muss of having to do all the work. Wally goes into the yards and he makes all this amazing product in that. I'd say a quarter of what Wally grows ends up in my restaurant, and then I know that at least three other restaurants in Saskatoon are utilizing what he grows as well. Wally is an incredibly humble, amazing gardener, that grower, producer, does all this fantastic stuff. Okay. And then we have the Simpkins family, Audrey, Rob, Jennifer, and Dixon. And Audrey is second generation on their farm, and then she's handing it off to Rob, her eldest son. And they grow everything. Literally everything: corn, zucchinis, eggplants, pumpkins, squashes, carrots, onions, tomatoes, peas, green beans, you can name it, they grow it. And their farm overlooks is on a riverbank on the south, in the northwest corner of the city, and actually they used to be able to look onto great farmland and that, but nowadays there's actually a building, a big housing subdivision being built on the opposite side of the riverbank, so their kind of view sucks now, but... I wouldn't necessarily say that their stuff's organic. I don't think that they kind of believe in that, but their stuff is incredibly fresh. It's beautiful. They grew zucchini squash for me, or zucchini or squash flowers for me this year. Just fabulous, fabulous people, and have been there for forever. And actually, Audrey's husband, his brother, has the same kind of a farm too, and he deals at the farmer's market as well. Then we go up to Tom Blacklock, whose grandfather brought in some of the first Black Angus cattle into Saskatchewan in early 1900s. I'm not 100% sure which year, but they can trace their entire herd right back to that first cow steer that they brought into Saskatchewan. The meat is amazing. It's all hormone-free, antibiotic-free. It's all free-range. It's all naturalized beef that's been fed on grass. And in the wintertime, I think it's all on hay and alfalfa, but I'd have to ask Tom about that. But I get a lot of... all my beef comes from him, and it's amazing. He's in Grandora, which is about 20 minutes southeast of us. The first time I went out to visit Tom was in the middle of winter time, and the whole prairie's white. And then when you come up to the ranch and that, there's these huge black dots all over the place. And when you kind of realize what they are, it's actually the cattle kicking around. It's unreal. He's very proud of what he does, and he should be. It's probably some of the best beef anybody's ever had that I can think of. And then we're going down to Steve and Brandy. Steve Cavan owns Paddockwood Microbrewery, which is I'm not sure if it's still the smallest microbrewery in Saskatchewan or in Canada anymore. It physically is quite tiny, but they produce a heck of a lot of beer, and success has certainly caught up with Paddockwood, as you can now find it in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia. If you're in Victoria at Spinnaker's, Paddockwood is there, and there's a premium beer store in downtown Vancouver that carries their stuff as well. It's all handcrafted, all with the old school recipes and that. He has a number of lagers, pilsners, bitters and ales. He has all some really amazing, interesting stuff. And actually, Steve used to be a history professor at the University of Saskatchewan, and going to one of his classes, my wife went to one of his classes, and he was all about, you know, the Greek mythology, and it was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was very entertaining to go and just listen to his classes. And he always would point out that he had a web link to his beer store. So it was really cool. What we do on once a month is we do specialized dinners based on a theme, like French or Italian cooking. And every 6 months I do a Padaquid dinner, and I sell it out. Like, the minute we announce it, people are like, okay, we want to be a part of this. And it's 5-6 courses, and each course is complemented with one of his beers, and we cook with a particular beer in each course. And it's actually it's opened a little bit of the horizons for me to kind of expand my cooking abilities in that, to be using beer in that. And then we go over to Pat Giddings, who owns Grandeur Gardens, which is a huge sets of greenhouses that does tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, and chilies, and that. And actually, Pat's next door neighbor with Tom, so their yards are not very far apart, and their lands are side by side. So she's too in Grandora. But the pepper plants, it's what's amazing is you go into these greenhouses, and the greenhouses are, you walk in, and the pepper plants are about 50 feet long, but the greenhouse is 15 feet high, so the plant is wrapped up and down. So it's all green on the outside, but if you lift the back, like the kind of top layer of green, it's just color. Red, orange, yellow, green, whatever. Or in the case of the tomatoes are all kind of on the bottom, and it's just pure red all the way across. She has yellow, orange, red, Romas, beefsteak, grape tomatoes, cocktail tomatoes. There's all sorts of different kinds of stuff that she does. And then she doesn't run year-round, unfortunately. They have about 3 months of where they have to regenerate everything. But it's from like mid-January to mid-April that I'm unable to procure anything from them. But once they start in the spring, I know that she's back online when I start getting lettuces from her, because she does a little shot of lettuce at the start and the end of the seasons. And then last but not least, we have Jim and Chris, who own South River Bison. And for people that would know Saskatoon, we have Warman is just north of Saskatoon by about 20 minutes. But in between the two is Wanuskewin Native Heritage Site. I think it's a historical site where one of the first Native settlements in Saskatoon was based, and they have a huge complex around that, and Jim and Chris's land butts up to that. So if you're really lucky and you're there, you can see all of the bison that they have in that, and they have a fair sized herd. The picture that we have of them actually is the two of them in one of their pastures with the bison kind of, they're actually walking away from us. And when we took the picture, my intrepid photographer said to Jim, can you maybe please, you know, herd them to come back this way? And Jim looked at them and steely eyed and said, no, I don't think so. They're mating right now. He says, they're a little bit ornery. And I was kind of looked at Jim, and I was like, oh boy, is this safe to be here? He's like, yeah, as long as they don't come back this way. And as soon as the minute Jim said that, the photographer took about 40 pictures in about 3 seconds and said, start packing the stuff up, and said, we're out of here. So we left. But some of those animals are a fair size in that. So mm-hmm. I'd hate to be caught in a stampede or something like that.
Now, from your understanding, are all of these farmers here on the wall doing well? Are they successful?
Yes.
Are they able to continue doing what they're doing?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Very, very much so. They all thrive. They all do quite well. Tom, I think, complains about being too busy sometimes, but there's not an issue with that. Wally, I think, expands every year the types of things that he grows. Steve, with the beer, after having 14 different varieties of beer, now has it down to 8. I think that's manageable for them, again, because of the size that they have. And this is maybe a third of all the people that we use. I still have Jonathan Phonos in Dory Lake that does all my whitewater fish, or freshwater fish in that. He fishes off of, I think, the 6th largest lake in Saskatchewan, and I get northern jackfish, pickerel, whitefish, burbot, which is kind of like a sucker fish, mullet, which is another kind of sucker fish. It's kind of like mungfish, too. You eat the ends of the tails and that, really, really succulent. Awesome fish. Northern Lights Organic Foods, we get wild rice. They're the largest producer in Saskatchewan, probably one of the largest producers in Canada, and mushrooms from them. There's a farm in Zenon Park that we get our chickpeas from, Clint Ringdahl in Hanley. All my lentils come from him. So I have lots of people all over the place that we bring specific items in from.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, and that was owner and chef Daniel Walker of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan's Vacheria, a restaurant clearly embodying a philosophy of social and environmental responsibility. And that segment was recorded while standing beside a wall within the restaurant featuring photographs of the suppliers we were just introduced to. And you can learn more about Vacheria by visiting the restaurant's website at vacheriarestaurant.ca, and Vacheria is spelt W-E-C-Z-E-R-I-A. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. And I also thank CJLY volunteers Chris Bourne, Neil Sorokin, and David Strongman for helping with the on-site recording of the conference featured on today's broadcast. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner or by dialing 250-352-9600.